You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Well, the secret is out that not only do I like to eat, but I like to cook. And one of the joys of cooking for me is understanding and appreciating the chemistry that creates the foods we like to eat. For many of us, though even accomplished scientists and engineers, the science that happens in the kitchen is, well, a little mysterious, like the difference between using a stainless steel or a copper bowl to whip egg whites. How could that possibly matter? But it does. Copper bowls give much better results. Or have you ever considered why we make brownies at a much lower temperature than we bake peanut butter cookies? I'll give you a hint. It has something to do with the melting point of sugar. What about steaks? Why do most people like the medium rare and not cook through like a brick? The secret is how the meat's protein reacts to heat. These are just some of the sciencey tips you can find in Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Hacks, and Good Food, a new book out by my next guest. Jeff Potter is a software engineer and author of Cooking for Geeks. He joins us here in our New York studios. Welcome to Science Friday, Jeff.
Thank you.
And thanks for bringing some of that food with you.
You're welcome.
Let me ask you first, why do geeks need their own cookbook?
Good question. Well, what does it mean to be a geek? Should probably start there. Mm-hmm. For so many of us who are in the software and technology background, you know, it's very easy to think about what a geek means, but there's a much broader definition. To me, a geek is anybody who's curious about the details about how things work. So that might not be a technology geek. That might be a car geek or somebody who's into sports. Just anybody who's curious about how things work, well, they'd be a geek in some form. So when it comes to the kitchen, somebody that has that sort of curiosity about the details needs something more than just a recipe. Recipes are just do this, do that, but they don't really tell you what's going on behind the instructions.
Exactly. I must be a food geek. That's exactly how I feel. I want to know when I'm mixing that stuff together, right?
Absolutely.
What's going on? And not only that, I want to know how I can change the equipment I'm using.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely.
To work more geeky, work better to exactly that. And you talk all about this in your book.
Yeah. And, you know, when it comes to somebody who thinks that way, putting things together, you really need to understand the basic fundamentals, not just kind of a series of instructions, which is why in the book I spent a lot of time thinking about the food science. And there are a couple of books out there that deal with, mm-hmm. you know, either food science, and there's lots of books that deal with recipes, but there are very few that are food science with recipes to illustrate and explain what the details mm-hmm. actually mean.
Mm-hmm. If you like to cook, if you're a geek, our number is 1-800-989-8255. You can send us a tweet at SciFry at SCIFRI. Also go to our website and have a discussion going there at sciencefriday.com. And let's kick this off with some food that you brought.
Okay. So I brought a little bit of stuff into the studio with me today. I'm actually going to start with the coolest geek toy ever.
What is that?
Now, I'm holding what's called an infrared thermometer.
Wow. It's like a laser beam coming at it.
It has an infrared, it's got a little, you know, laser beam to help you sight it. But here, right. I'll hand it to you, and you can point it at things. And what it does is it tells you the surface temperature of whatever you're pointing it at.
Wow, this is geeky. 85, right. You point at you or the table or whatever.
Sure. Now, when it comes to the kitchen,
right.
since so much of cooking is about the physical and chemical reactions that occur, and those reactions occur at different temperatures, understanding what temperature means in the kitchen is really important.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not just, you know, the temperature that's important. There's also things like physiology and psychology of taste.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing I discuss in the book is about flavor combinations, and what I've brought in today is watermelon and feta. One's sweet, one's salty, but the two together are actually a surprisingly good combination.
All right, so you got a big, nice tub of watermelon cut up.
Yep.
You can put it out there. And that's right. A lot of people like the salt and the salty and the sweet combination.
Yeah.
They follow one. Sometimes if you have popcorn, you say, I've got to have some chocolate or something, right?
Sure. And it turns out that there's a lot of different combinations where when you're cooking something, not just thinking about the seasoning and the flavors, but also thinking about the primary taste as a way of adjusting things. So I've taken a little bit of the feta cheese and some balsamic vinegar and olive oil that I'm just going to pour on top of this.
Ooh, that looks good. So it's feta, olive oil, it's watermelon, and some onions.
Yep. And a little bit of red onions just to kind of spice it up and give it a little more interest. And I'll hand this bowl to you here, and you can kind of take a taste of these things together.
Talk amongst yourselves.
Yes, I'm sorry that.
While I eat this, this is. Let me get the one with the. It's got with the vinegar on it. Try it. That's good.
Thank
very
you.
Good. That's right. It's one at the same time.
Yeah. Well, the two together are really, you know, it's a common enough thing that's been done out there, but to actually see that example, you know, cantaloupe and melon and things like prosciutto are commonly done. And again, it's a similar kind of combination of flavors. So exploring kind of the gustatory system and the taste system and getting that kind of science background behind it means when you step into the kitchen,
it tastes good. And you know why it's happening.
And you know why
Let's talk about the temperature. I mentioned in the beginning why you cook brownies at a certain temperature and why you cook other things. What's going on?
Sugar, this actually took me a while to figure out and understand, my background being software engineering. Sugar caramelization and sugar melting are two different things entirely. Sugar caramelizes starting around, well, somewhere between 320, 340. And as you get up to 380 and above, it starts to get really toasted and dark and burnt and bitter. But at 367 exactly, it happens to melt. It's a pure substance. So 365, it'll be solid. 370, it'll be melted. And this is actually really clever because you can use this to calibrate your oven.
Oh, because those thermometers really are so poor at having an accurate temperature.
Right. We all know that water boils at 212.
Right.
And sugar melts at 367.
So exactly.
So if you put it in an environment colder than that, it shouldn't melt.
Right.
If you put it in something hotter than that, it should melt.
Wow.
Now, if you're going to do this at home, keep in mind that just like taking an ice cube out of the freezer, it takes a little while for things to melt when they're only a few degrees up from their melting point.
Right.
So you can take a little bit of sugar, put it in a bowl, and toss it in your oven at 350, and it shouldn't melt even after an hour, and set it to 375, and it might take half hour.
Right. What are some of the other key temperatures?
Sure. Well, the Maillard reaction, 310 degrees, is, of course, one of the most commonly— The Maillard reaction?
The Maillard reaction.
And it's one that's most commonly known. It starts around 310. This is why we do our roasts at 325 or hotter. If you roast meat at 300, you're not going to get that nice brown outside. And then when it actually comes to the texture of meat and meat cooking itself, of course, that roast is not going to be internally at 310 degrees. It's going to be somewhere in the order of, call it 140, 150, depending upon how you like your meat done. And that's based on the two temperatures that myosin and actin, which are two different proteins that occur in mammalian meat, denature. And we just happen to prefer texturally when myosin denatures, which starts around 122.
Denature means the proteins unfold?
Yeah. Denature means that the actual structure of it changes.
Right.
And as a process, as a result of that, it also changes its texture.
Mm-hmm.
And so what scientists have found is that when you take meat and cook it at those temperatures where the myosin denatures but the actin remains native, there's this great term, total textural preference, that they use in the literature.
TTP.
I haven't seen it abbreviated.
I'll put it in there.
Sure.
Yeah, total textural preference.
And they find that we happen to like it between, you know, those two proteins, one being cooked and one being in its original form.
Mm-hmm. So that's the point where something goes from really rare to maybe a little bit.
Right. And it's a time at temperature reaction. So it does take some time. It's not like, say, sugar, which melts instantly. It's a much more complicated thing.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to some geeks on the phone. Alex in Concord, Massachusetts. Hi, Alex.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Okay. So I am a huge food geek. And currently I'm trying to major in food science, though I have more of a comment that what you're talking about is more of food chemistry and molecular gastronomy under food science, and that in food science there's multiple different types. For instance, the type I'm going into is I'm trying to go into food genetics.
Ah.
So
Food genetics.
Yeah, tell me more about this.
What's food genetics?
It's I guess that's more of what I could sum it up as. It's working with GMOs. Like genetically modified organisms with plants. And my goal is when I finally major in this is to work on allergies.
I see. All right, Alex, thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get another geek on the line. But tell us, before we do, how you modified, was it a crock pot to become a super— I mean, I thought a crock pot is warm enough. You made it to cook even longer.
So there's two different things here.
Yeah.
One is the whole idea of using a crock pot for, there's a cooking technique called sous vide cooking, which is just a French term that means under vacuum, describes one step in the process. When you hold food at certain temperatures, just like that sugar melting, you can cause certain proteins to react, denature and keep others native. Mm-hmm. So there's this whole movement of doing sous vide cooking where you take and cook meats or fruits or vegetables even at precise temperatures to control what reactions occur. It's something that comes out of the lab.
Right.
You can use a sous vide. You can make your own sous vide rig using a crock pot if you don't want to go and buy, you know, the $1,000 industrial what they use in chemistry labs. But what you do with a crock pot is you basically get a thermocoupler, a controller that reads that and then interpose on the power supply to the crock pot to turn it on and off to basically make it a more precise crock pot.
So you have a temperature gauge in the crock pot that
yes.
reads that senses, oh, time to turn the crock pot off for a bit.
Exactly.
So it cycles it on and off.
And all that's doing is making it more precise than the thermostat that's internally present in the crock pot. So again, since so much of cooking is about time and temperature, collagen happens to hydrolyze and denature starting around somewhere in the order of, let's call it 160, depends upon some specifics we won't get into here.
Mm-hmm.
Crockpots, you know, are designed to allow for long, slow things to hydrolyze and denature in the collagen. The other thing I did, which I wasn't quite sure if you were getting towards, was the very high heat cooking. I happen to have broken my oven door doing this.
Don't try beep beep beep. Don't try this at home. Okay, go ahead. Tell us what happened.
So there's one of the people I interviewed in the book. The book's got about two or three dozen interviews. One's
right.
a guy named Jeff Verasano down in Atlanta who clipped the lock off of his oven door so he could open it while on cleaning cycle.
It gets really hot.
It does
in cleaning
cycle. And using
that's
this,
why it's locked.
And using this geek toy, the infrared thermometer,
right.
you can find out that it runs about 1,000 degrees.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what can you do with a 1,000-degree oven?
You can cook a pizza in 45 seconds.
And only a geek would have thought of that.
And
taken advantage of it. So you cracked open your oven door so that you could make the oven work
right.
while it was in the cleaning, the
right.
self-cleaning phase.
I replicated Jeff Arisano's work and found, in fact, it does make fantastic pizza. I broke my oven door in the process, and I now have, instead of glass, what was called pyroceram. It's what the military used in the 1950s for missile nose cones. That's now what I've got for my oven door. It's a sheet of the stuff that is temperature-rated to much higher temperatures, but definitely not something to try it at home. Cooking your pizzas on a grill with a wood fire really is much easier and gets just as hot.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Jay in Manchester, New Hampshire. Hi, Jay.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. I'm enjoying the conversation very much. I've worked in restaurants for years, cook a lot at home, but I need to hear your guests say two words, Alton Brown.
There he did. Thank
Anybody
you for
that
calling.
Can make a 6-year-old enjoy her vegetables has got a thumbs up in my book.
Exactly. I just give the devil his due. Alton Brown, personal hero of mine.
Absolutely.
And just give a little name recognition there because he started the whole ball rolling.
There's a lot of people, and he's done an amazing amount of contributing towards the public's appreciation of food science. Of course, the other big name is Harold McGee, whose reference and tome on food and cooking is a fabulous reference book.
All right. Thanks for calling, Jay. 1-800-989-8255. We're talking about Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Hacks, Good Food with Jeff Potter, very interesting book, on Science Friday from NPR. One other interesting, there's so much interesting things to talk about. We've all eaten things with liquid smoke, a smoky flavor, but you actually say in Cooking for Geeks how to make the liquid smoke yourself at home.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work.
That shouldn't stop any geek from
Well, this is true. Basically, you need to take whatever your smoke source is, wood chips, hickory chips, and get them in a closed environment using chemistry equipment to do
right.
it properly and get them up to temperature and water distill the smoke. You can kind of jokingly think of it as a water bong, where the water that's left over after doing the smoke filtration is your liquid smoke. And actually doing it this way through the filtration removes some of the potential carcinogens that either will precipitate out or float to the top and you can skim off.
So the water goes through through a little tube into some – the smoke goes
smoke
through
goes,
a little
right.
tube
you do
into
it in a,
some
you do
water.
It in a closed vessel
right.
and heat it, and the smoke generated from that will come up through your tubing into water and you filter it through the water.
Is that how you make Coke or something when you heat something in a closed vessel? I mean, a kind of carbon that comes out of it.
No idea.
Something like that. And so then you can take the water, put it in a little jug, and flavor things with it.
You can, although, again, it's pretty dilute at that point.
Yeah.
And it turns out that this surprised me, because a lot of people have opinions about chemicals in food and mm-hmm. think of liquid smoke as being a chemical. Now, of course, food is chemical. You know, whether it be
right.
the watermelon feta salad you had earlier or whatever it is you buy at your grocery store, food is basically chemical. And it turns out that liquid smoke is, when it in its purest essence, is really nothing more than the smoke vapor distilled through water.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no chemical reaction occurring between something you're roasting or grilling and that smoke. So you can actually
right.
deposit that smoky flavor on later, which means you can do fun things like put that smoke essence into things that you wouldn't normally be able to smoke, such as, say, s'mores ice cream.
Ooh.
Which was actually, there's a group down here in New York called the Experimental Cuisine Collective that actually had a talk and a demo on this last year that I very much enjoyed. And there's a little bit of information about this in the book.
1-800-989-8255, talking with Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Hacks, Good Food. A couple of minutes before the break, a project that you would love to do, but you haven't got time to do yet. A geek project that if you had,
I've had
an infinite amount of money and you wanted to do
I think if I had an infinite amount of money, one of the crazy things I've wanted to do is, I don't know really where this idea came from, and my publishers will probably shudder. Sorry, guys.
Mm-hmm.
Make a gin and tonic while skydiving.
Make it in while – are you a skydiver?
I've never actually – done any skydiving, no.
I'm willing to bet you it's been done.
I'm sure, but I haven't seen it. And, you know, it sounds kind of crazy and fun, but heck, why not?
Well, you need to make a kit, I guess.
And
you know,
I guess the other geek dream would be actually be to eat at El Bulli. This is one of the preeminent restaurants in Spain, Ferran Andrea, who's well known for combining science and food to produce new and interesting dishes in a true art fashion.
Is there a device that, like a new kind of Cuisinart or something that you would love to have that doesn't exist? That think of something original. I don't have to think now. We're going to go to the break. But think, and I'll, everybody, at 1-800-989-8255, we're talking with geeks about food and equipment. What piece of equipment could we all put our heads together? We could crowdsource this.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. What piece of equipment do you need to have in your kitchen besides that oven that cooks the pizza in 40 seconds that we don't have now, and maybe we can think about it, building it together? 1-800-989-8255. Tweet at SciFry, talking with Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Hacks, Good Food, a new book out by software engineer Jeff Potter. And while we're talking about cooking and about different kinds of tastes and flavors, I'd like to bring on another guest. If you can't get enough of, we talked about it, the spicy sriracha sauce, or you'd like to eat whole jalapenos for a snack, you might be getting a little unexpected benefit along with the burn. Here to talk about it is my guest, William Sessa, director of the Vascular Biology and Therapeutics Program at Yale University School of Medicine in New Haven. He's also professor of pharmacology there, and he joins us over the phone. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Sessa.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're welcome. You have a new study out that says that eating these hot chili peppers lowers blood pressure, at least in rats. Nice.
Yeah. So basically, it actually wasn't that our study. I wrote the commentary on this study. And basically, it was a surprising finding because most people believe that obviously hot chili peppers will cause pain, the sensation of pain, whereas in this study, when they gave it to animals chronically, particularly animals that have high blood pressure, the active ingredient actually lowered blood pressure in the animals. So it was quite remarkable.
Is there any evidence in our popular culture that people who eat hot, spicy things do have lower blood pressure?
Well, you know, in the United States, I'm not aware of such epidemiological literature, but there are some studies, I believe, in certain parts of Asia where certain populations do eat a lot of foods containing hot chili peppers, and they tend to have less cardiovascular disease. Now, this is purely anecdotal at this point, but it's sort of provocative.
And what is the mechanism for it working?
Yeah, so I'd say probably about 15 years ago now, several scientists identified sort of receptors or proteins that bind natural products. And so the major natural product from chili peppers is a chemical called capsaicin. And so what was shown in this paper was that capsaicin, by binding to its receptor, would activate a pathway that's known to lower blood pressure in humans as well as in animals. And this is primarily the nitric oxide system. You may have heard of this system. This system resulted in a Nobel Prize to three investigators in 1998. Nitric oxide is a system that your body makes this gas that keeps blood vessels dilated and lowers blood pressure. So they showed basically that the active ingredient from the chili pepper activated this system in your body to lower blood pressure.
Mm-hmm. I think it's how Viagra and things like that work also.
Absolutely, that's correct.
And it was called Jirasi, one of the Nobel winners who has been on our program to talk about it a lot. So you know that this might be the mechanism for it working, but we don't know if it really works in people. So far, these studies you cite are done in laboratory animals.
Yes. So some of the early studies in the paper were using human cells showing that this pathway is operational. But then to show that this was relevant in an intact system, they went to hypertensive rats. Mm-hmm. So you're correct. There is no evidence in humans that this actually will work as of yet.
But, you know, capsaicin causes a lot of pain. Now, you eat some of those chili peppers, you're not going to want to eat them again. How can some people eat so many chili peppers?
Absolutely. No, that's a very good question because it's very difficult to imagine that your nerve endings respond to this to give you the sensation of pain. But at the same time, your blood vessels will sense this and it will increase blood flow. Now, we know that during the sensation of pain, there's increases in blood flow, so nature has co-opted this dual mechanism to actually do both. But you can imagine a system where if you were able to actually hit the cardiovascular receptor but not the nerve receptor, perhaps you can have a beneficial effect without the heat, so to speak.
Mm. And I guess for people who constantly eat chili peppers, they must get acclimated to it.
Yeah, well, what happens is that even when in experimental models, when they give this capsaicin, which is the active ingredient, chronically, you do become desensitized to it eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here with Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks. You know anything about anecdotal stuff about chili peppers?
I've got one good one. One of the interviews I did was with a nutritional researcher from Cornell, and she told me this wonderful story. She had said that the neurotransmitter, I guess she said it was called substance P. I think P stood for pain or, I guess, well, that's what I'd heard. Mm-hmm. She had said that it deplenishes over, several weeks exposure to it. After not being exposed to it for a couple of weeks, it would start to replenish and come back up in its levels. And she was saying in Cornell in the mid-80s, she would have students come over from India where they were used to very spicy food with a lot of capsaicin. And they would start eating the dorm food that at that time didn't have so much capsaicin, mm-hmm. chili peppers, whatnot in it. And then they would go back home and they'd eat their mother's cooking. Ah, the laughter there. Yes, exactly. Because they couldn't stand it because their substance P levels had replenished.
Yes.
And they would go, this is so hot, I can't eat it. And their mothers would say, what has America done to you? They've corrupted you.
That's funny.
That's funny. Well, Dr. Sessa, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today. Thanks for filling us in on that research.
Thank you very much.
William Sessa is director of the Vascular Biology and Therapeutics Program at Yale University School of Medicine in New Haven, and he's a professor of pharmacology there. Our number 1-800-989-8255 still with me is Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Hacks, Good Food, Good Book.
Thank you.
Jeff, really interesting read. Tell us a little bit about one of the things that you mentioned in the book is the constant confusion that even good cooks, chefs have over baking powder and baking soda.
Ah, yes.
What's the difference?
The difference. Well, baking soda itself is just a bicarbonate. It's, a single thing, whereas baking powder is a self-contained system of both bicarbonates and an acid that will react with it. Mm-hmm. So with baking soda, you have to put it into a food that has enough acid to react with it, whereas baking powder is pretty much just, add water and heat, and you've got air.
Right.
And what surprised me was in two of the interviews with people I shall remain nameless, but they're both in the public eye for explaining doing recipes and that sort of thing. Both of them said they were confused about how to kind of tell which one to use and when.
That's what they did for a living. So
it is a little bit complicated sometimes, yeah. But it basically comes down to the food you're cooking. Since we're using things like baking powders and baking mm-hmm. sodas to generate air to give lift to foods that we bake, especially, you basically use baking soda to the point where there's not enough acids left for it to react with, and if you still need more leavening, you then switch to using baking powder, which is why some things will call for both baking soda and baking powder. This is why if you look at a recipe for buttermilk pancakes, the buttermilk itself has got a fair amount of acid in it, so the recipe will call for baking soda, but a more traditional pancake recipe will just call for baking powder.
Well, we asked our friends out there, and tweets are coming in about what machine they would like to have in their kitchen. And I got a couple of very interesting answers. And one that I had thought about, one answer is our contact wrote that we need an instant freezer.
An instant freezer.
In other words, like you have a microwave oven that instantly heats things up. Can we find the opposite of that?
You know,
and something instantly freeze dries something.
You can certainly use liquid nitrogen for that if you happen to have some and know how to use it and are safe and careful. Industrial processors do have blast freezers that they use for freezing things like string beans or broccoli that are right after they're picked from harvest.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, if you freeze things more quickly, the water crystals inside the structure of whatever you're freezing will be smaller, so less likely to make cellular damage, so better texture.
Right. And another suggestion was something I had seen myself and wondered if you could buy this for your kitchen if you'd need one, and that is the kitchen equivalent of the stir plate with the stir bar in it. You've seen in the labs, you know, it sits on a little platform and there's a metal piece that's rotating inside the beaker.
You know,
wouldn't we like to have that?
That actually sounds kind of
useful. Mixing drinks or whatever for our
I think
our
there
self,
is like vaguely
equivalent?
Somewhere
yeah.
in the back of my
think
head
so?
Is a memory of something that does that for stews and like kind of clamp on top of a, you know, it goes on top of a pot and it's an electric motor that does that.
Right.
But
Well, somebody, I'm sure.
Somebody out there can
somebody
make
will
it.
Tell it will tell us about. The other thing that a gadget that gets very little mention but is still very useful these days is the pressure cooker.
Mm.
Right? And the other one is the coffee percolator. I guess I'm watching Mad Men too much and reminding myself of these old things that I had as a kid. There's no real way to improve on a pressure cooker, would there? I guess you could make it get hotter inside so that you get more pressure, but that
you don't
want to do that.
Yeah,
take off of the moon. You don't want that.
At some point, the reactions that you have occurring in the food, you know, they're occurring. You either are above the reaction temperature or you're not. I mean, okay, yeah, there's time and temperature. Mm-hmm. It does matter, but it seems like the pressure cookers probably get high enough pressure for most purposes.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get a phone caller. And Laverne in Napa Valley, California, wants to know. Hi, come on.
Yeah,
give
hi.
Us your question. Hi, how are you?
Laverne Mac. I've been a geek for 85 years, which is also my age. I think I was born with a handful of electrons. And this thing about this infrared thermometer really fascinates me. Is that actually something that's on the market today?
Yes, it is. And in fact, they're relatively cheap. Mine's about $50.
No kidding.
It works just by looking, you know, it's basically got a single pixel camera, if you think of it that way. Think about something like coal in a fire and how it's glowing. And you can see that. And
could you throw a brand name at me so I could trace that?
You know, I think that the most common brand is probably the meters made by Fluke. The one I have here says E.
Fluke is an instrument manufacturer, as I recall.
Right.
Yeah. The
I'm
one
sure
I
if you just Google it, you'll find a million of them.
Infrared thermometer is what I would search for online.
Good luck.
Yeah.
You know, and what that would be good for? You know, they say it's hot enough day to fry an egg on this.
You know, the New York Times did a piece on this about a month ago, and I was thinking to myself as I was reading through it, they didn't know the actual temperature of the surface. Eggs don't begin to cook and denature until 142, 144 Fahrenheit. If you had an IR thermometer, you could go find the perfect spot to fry your egg on the sidewalk.
And the perfect car hood. A much better spot if you're going to actually eat the egg.
Well, if the New York Times wants to do a revised version, I can lend them my IR thermometer.
1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we get another call. Steve in Vancouver. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, hi there. I just wanted to make a comment. I'm an appliance repairman, and I don't want too many service calls on this. on the 500 degrees or the 350 degrees in the oven portion with the sugar, ovens are radiant temperatures, so they go up and down as they try and do the heating. So we take an average of a high temp and a low temp in the oven, so we get 350.
Yes, absolutely. They do cycle up and down. And I've actually found that by putting something like a pizza stone in your oven, you can help regulate that heat and get a much more even heat. I've metered mine at home, and it actually – mine's an electric one. And it, with the pizza stone directly above the heating element on the bottom. It blocks any radiant heat directly, and I find that mine only cycles by about a degree. If you're going to do the sugar thing, which really use an oven thermometer, it's much better. But if you're going to do the sugar thing, keep in mind that your oven obviously does cycle up and down, which is why you want to, you know, leave 10 or 15 degrees leeway in each side.
Mm-hmm. It does, and the old thermostats had a higher variance. The computer ovens are a lot closer right on, but the old thermostats had a really high variance, so you would melt your sugar, and then you'd call me, and I'd make lots of money off of that.
There you go. We'll keep you in business.
I thought I'd let somebody know about that.
There you go. Thanks for calling. Have a good weekend. 1-800-989-8255. We're talking about science, cooking for geeks with the real science, great hacks, good food. Jeff Potter is here on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. We got a response on how you can make that stirring equipment. Let's see. I got it down there. Home brewers, it says on my tweet, and it comes from PB Haas. Home brewers use rare earth magnets glued to computer fans to make their own stir plates.
That's very clever.
Can you picture that?
Yeah.
Yeah, a computer fan circulating around. And it's I guess you got to wash it off a little before. And now they're, Lord knows, surplus of all kinds of computer fans. 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get a quick phone call in here from Benoit in Los Altos. Hi.
Yes. Hi. Good morning. I always thought that using some of those low-cost laser engraver to do patterning on top of steak would be something kind of interesting to do. You could redo custom logo or custom a grill pattern on steak and be able to easily control that with a computer. And I would assume that those laser engravers are powerful enough to do a nice burn layer on the top of your steak or vegetables.
Yes, wow. This actually reminds me of two different things. One is that some students at the MIT Media Lab some number of years ago actually did exactly that, where they were basically printing onto food. And the second thing that comes to mind is actually there's two individuals who are Lenore and Wendell of Evil Mad Science, who have actually used a laser cutter to etch in an Apple logo on top of the pie pastry for an apple pie, making an apple pie.
Wow! And you know, now that we have inkjet printers, and people are putting all kinds of stuff in the container where the ink used to be, you can print anything, right? And a piece of paper, not just a printed circuit, but something edible.
Mm-hmm. Nori, right? Seaweed.
Seaweed. Good idea.
It's been done.
It's been done.
It's amazing how much stuff in food has been done.
Well, you know, you see these birthday cakes with the pictures on top that must have gone through.
And then you have things like fail cake, where, you know, somebody says to the person icing the cake, you know, make sure to add such and such, and they actually ice the cake with those words as opposed to just knowing them as instructions. There's a website out there that I don't remember the URL of, but it's photographs of failed cakes that kind of the logical extension of that.
So what's next for you? Where are you going when no other person dares to go?
That is a good question. I don't know. Right now, I'm just having a lot of fun with this book and getting it out there in front of people and, you know, really hoping that people get a chance to get into the kitchen, try new things, not be so afraid of bringing the dinner and, you know, go experiment and play.
Mm-hmm. And summertime is a great time.
Oh, absolutely.
Especially since you're outdoors, and if you make a mistake, easier to clean up, right?
Absolutely.
If you're barbecuing and you want to get that char on top and bottom, what's the best temperature? Do you need a meat thermometer to do that well?
Well, what you're talking about, like charring a hamburger?
Yeah.
This gets into the whole food safety thing.
Right.
When it comes to things like steaks, when it comes to food in general, cooking them at a high enough temperature to kill any pathogens that might be on the surface is really important. But things like steak, we're not so worried about the middle of that steak when it's what's called whole muscle intact. But things like hamburgers are ground up where there's all outside.
So you want to cook it.
You know, from a food safety point of view, you want to get it up to at least the USDA recommended temperature, which offhand I think is 160 for an instant kill.
Mm-hmm. And that's what we were hoping for that. Thank you. Thank you, Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Hacks, Good Food, Good Book.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on with us today.
My pleasure.
So he's a software engineer, and you can get the book at Amazon, and it's in Kindle and all kinds of forms like that. All right. Thanks again. Our producer of this program, it's over for this hour, include Christopher Taliata, senior producer at Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Laura Lickman, our multimedia editor, Alicia Bayak, our Spanish language producer, Neil Rausch, our technical director and at the controls here in New York. Our science and arts producer is Catherine Wells. And if you missed anything that we talked about today, you can go to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can podcast it. Also, you can download it. Download our iPhone app for instant access to Science Friday. You can take it with you, and you can do all that from our website. And also, we're tweeting all day at SciFri, at SEIFRI. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.